This activity continued through the night, and by the time the sky, glimpsed through irregular patches overhead, began lightening, Thedo, Ronsard, and Mirmior stood on the far bank, looking at their handiwork.
All that remains is to drain the hollow once more, and we will need hot coals to use with the arrows.
Then we wait. We should have a few hours to give the men rest before the first of the Ningal come through here.
I am for it. We have done a labor this night. Let us pray that it has been a good purpose. We will do what remains and then deploy our men to their appointed places.
So saying, the lords turned at once to finish their tasks. Then, as the thin light of morning filtered down into the murky dell, all fell silent. All was ready, and there was not the barest hint that everything was not as it should be, that it was not all it seemed. An army waited among the ferns and in the trees and behind the turfy hillocks, and was invisible. The first of the Ningal to come through the hollow were the scouts. They crossed the ford and passed on, unaware of the army lying in wait on either hand. The next to pass were rank upon rank of horsemen. And just as Mirmior had hoped, the horses churned the hollow into a mud pit and made the far bank, already slick with the muck Ronsard's men had created, a treacherous slide. But they too passed on unaware. The sun arched to midday when the first of the footmen started across the ford. Hundreds of men, line upon line, waded through the waist-deep water and slithered up the far bank with difficulty. Thedo could see them as they poured into the hollow and noted with satisfaction that the soldiers moved more slowly now as the mire deepened and sucked at their feet. Suddenly, a horse and rider appeared at the edge of the ford. It was a warlord on his black steed, and Thedo could tell he was unhappy with the time it was taking his soldiers to cross the stream. The warlord sat straight in the saddle and looked long up and down the Orkinril. Thedo held his breath. Had the warlord spotted something amiss? Was their trap discovered? But the grim lord swung his horse and plunged through the stream and disappeared on the other side. Nin's soldiers were crossing in masses now, 100 at a time. They staggered muddily to the ford and plunged in, then flung themselves up the far bank like fish flopping out of water. Another warlord appeared, surrounded by 20 horsemen. He waited, as the other had, watching the men cross the stream, and then splashed across.
The wagons, get ready.
The wagons were what they had been waiting for. According to Mirmior's knowledge of the movements of the Ningal, they most often traveled with their weapons and supplies in the wagons, half of their troops going before and the rest after. It was the second half of the Ningal host, which the defenders would attack. Thedo peered cautiously through the man-high ferns to see the first of the heavy wagons, mired nearly to its axles in the hollow, now trampled into a swampy bog by the hundreds of feet of men and horses which had passed before. Thedo's hand sought the hilt of his sword. He knew that even now 1,000 arrows were being notched to their strings in anticipation of the signal that would not be long delayed.
Not yet. Give the others time to move up into position, and allow those who have passed on to distance themselves from the ambush.
The Ningal, by sheer force of numbers, had succeeded in hauling the wagons to the brink of the ford. But now other wagons were entering the hollow and succumbing to the morass. Shortly, the hollow was filled with wagons, hopelessly mired, and hundreds of soldiers clustering around them in an effort to budge them along.
Now! Do it now!
Thedo drew his sword and stepped calmly from the ferns. He raised the sword, knowing that all eyes were now on him. He dropped his arm, and the archers let loose as one. The dim air of the dank dell was instantly alight with darting flames arcing to earth like stars falling from on high. The flaming arrows found their marks, the wagons. In moments, the wagons were afire. The Dragon King's archers then hailed down arrows upon the enemy without mercy. The rout had only begun, however, when it was turned by the appearance of the two remaining warlords. One came pounding out of the wood, his bodyguard with him. The other warlord, with his mounted bodyguard, pointed his sword across the stream, and his warriors came galloping across the ford to where Thedo and Mirmior waited with a dozen knights. Thedo found himself suddenly ducking savage thrusts, which chopped the fern and sent greenery flying. Thedo threw up his sword to parry the slicing blows and grabbed the enemy's horse's bridle, pulling its head down. The animal went to its knees, and Thedo lunged at the rider, knocking him from the saddle. The knight's poniard did its work before the warrior could disengage himself from his thrashing mount. Thedo stepped away from the riderless horse beside him and saw a dozen Ningal axemen splashing toward him, the handles of their axes still smoldering in their grasp. Thedo caught the first one in the throat as the warrior raised his axe, but he had not withdrawn the blade when a second was upon him. Thedo saw the glint of the blade swing up, and he raised his shield, expecting his arm to be crushed by the impending blow, but the blow never came. Thedo dodged aside and saw Ronsard's familiar face beside him. Behind Ronsard, a host of knights stormed out of the wood where they had been concealed. The archers poured arrows upon the battlefield in a deadly rain. The unhappy waters of Beorkenril flowed red with the blood of the dead. Mirmior had planned the fight well, and the Ningal struggled in vain to gain the advantage. Had there been more time, or had the Dragon King's forces been larger, it would have turned out a day of victory for the stout-hearted defenders. But it was not to be. It was the howl of the raging Ningal who had passed over to Beorkenril, now returning, summoned by the sounds of battle. In moments, the Dragon King's forces were surrounded, and would have been swept away instantly. But Mirmior, ever alert to the unexpected, had saved one last trick.
Here! Do it now! Now!
The first tree crashed to earth, square upon the bodies of a troop of Ningal too startled to move. Their comrades dodged aside, only to be met by the second tree, which fell at an angle to the first. The terror inspired by this last trap was short-lived, however. Soon the iron-willed warlords had their men back in close command. With terrible efficiency, the warlords bore down upon the sturdy knights, cutting through their faltering defenses, and the tide of battle turned against the Dragon King's forces.
It is time to flee!
Ronsard was bleeding from a dozen shallow wounds, and his face, beneath the blood and grime, was gray with exhaustion.
Alas! I have just made a last survey of our position. We are surrounded on all sides. There is no escape.
We are completely cut off?
I fear as much. There are just too many of them.
To a better over quickly! I have no regrets!
Nor I, my friend. Though my heart is heavy at the thought of our country falling before these barbarians. But I have done all any man can.
Goodbye, brave friend! Is this the dark road you warned me of? How long ago it seems now!
It well may be, but wait!
Thedo turned and mounted the crest of the hillock.
Trumpeter! Sound your call! Sound it until your last breath! Do you hear? Sound it, I say! Fight on, brave sirs! Hold on!
Two men drove ahead, swords singing in the air as if they would single-handedly drive the invaders from their shores. The knights around them, heartened by the example of their dauntless leaders, put their shields together and dug in. If death came now, it would find them brave soldiers to the end. Quentin rose and stood looking across the polished surface of the Sky Lord's mirror. The deep of the night was upon the Fair Valley, and the moon now crouched low behind the western peaks of the Fiskills, firing their snowy caps with a white brilliance that reflected in the fathomless lake. Also reflected with startling clarity were the myriad stars burning like pieces of silver fire in the black vault of Heaven's Dome. The bright green turf of the valley was now gray in the subtle moonlight, and the leaping falls flowed down like liquid light, sending their ghostly mist to curl and eddy on the night air. Tolly, Derwin, and Inchkeith were asleep. Wrapped in their cloaks, they looked like lumps of earth or stone. So still and silent did they lay. How long he stood looking, Quentin did not know. Time seemed to hold no particular meaning in the valley. But Quentin was suddenly mindful of another sound, or rather the impression of a sound, which had been present for some time. Perhaps it had awakened him. The sound seemed to be coming from far above him. He turned his face to the sky and saw the Wolf Star, now shining directly overhead, filling the sky with blazing light, a light so bright it cast shadows upon the earth. The light made him cold, and Quentin pulled his cloak more tightly around his shoulders, but he could not take his eyes off the star. It seemed to be moving, stretching, growing thinner and pulling other stars into its dance, for it swirled and shimmered in the blackness of the sky like a living thing. The stars melted together into a single shaft of light, cold and hard as ice. Flashing shaft of light was the blade of a mighty sword. In a twinkling, Quentin realized he was seeing it, the Shalakir. The sword, its hilt of guttering golden stars with lordly jewels embedded, ruby, amethyst, topaz, and emerald, began to rise slowly, tilting upwards as the sword lifted in triumph. Then the tip dipped and slid and began falling through the black void of heaven, spinning as it fell and flashing fire into the darkness. The Shining One arrowed to earth in an arc of white fire. The brilliance of that plunge dazzled Quentin, but he looked on without flinching. The sword came to rest just above the peaks at the further end of the valley, where the falls of Shenid Velen poured out of the mountainside. It hovered there for an instant, and then slid slowly down, as a sword sliding home to its scabbard. There it remained for a moment, its glow diminishing rapidly and fading away in the sweeping mist. When Quentin came to, he was staring at the falls and the night lay deep around him. But burned into his brain was the image of the sword. And without a whisper of a doubt, he knew where he would find it.
Drew, wake up. Please wake up or it'll be too late.
Oh, what is it? What has happened?
I have seen Shalakir. I know where we will find it. Look, the falls, do you see?
Oh, it is you, Quentin. It is bad luck to disturb the sleep of a hermit. I thought you knew that.
I have seen the sword. Shalakir, I know where it will be found.
I do not see anything.
It is there. No. It is gone now. But it was there. I tell you, I saw it.
Wake in, Keith Tully. We will follow him since we seem to have no other choice.
In Keith is awake. What is all this, then?
My master has had a vision. He says he has seen the Shining One and knows where it will be found.
Quentin was leading them toward the falls along the grassy bank of the lake. The moon was down behind the mountains in the west, but their path was illumined by the unnaturally bright light of the Wolf Star. Quentin did not take his eyes from the falls ahead. It was as if he did not trust himself to remember what he had seen if he looked away for even an instant. The others hopped along behind him. A breathless hour's travel brought them near the base of the falls. Quentin was standing at the foot of the towering cascade when Derwin and Inchkeith came up. Quentin turned to them, his face glistening with the spray, mist curling around his shoulders and beating on his cloak like pearls which gleamed in the starlight.
There! The entrance to the mines is up there!
Impossible! What do you propose to do? Swim up the falls like a salmon?
I do not doubt what you saw. Let us see whether it answers the riddle. Let us see. When mountains sleep, sharp vigil keep. You shall see the way most clear.
Yes, I have seen it. The sword fell from the sky and disappeared into the falls.
I thought you were not listening, but that is very good. Yes, and it fits too. When you hear laughter among the clouds.
I heard it. The waterfall sounded like laughter.
Some laughter? I can hardly hear a word you're saying over the roar.
Among the clouds. See how the mist forms clouds. What else could it be?
Yes. And see, a curtain made of glass.
The water is a curtain. Take no care for hand nor hair. It is wet, and my hair is dripping, and so is my cloak. I'm soaking wet.
So it is!
We're all soaking wet, and fools for it!
Divide the thunder and seek the narrow way! Go through the waterfall? Do you suppose?
Of course! Yes, that is it! That is what I've been trying to tell you!
Give day for night, and withhold the light, and you have won the day. Well, it is night, but it could also mean that the entrance could only be seen in darkness, or that entering the mine in darkness would...
I see it!
Tolly, where is he?
The three looked around, but could see the plucky Jair nowhere. He had disappeared while they were puzzling over the clues of the riddle.
Here!
They looked to the falls, and suddenly Tolly was there, stepping out of the tumbling water as from behind a shimmering curtain. He seemed to be standing on the sheer rock face of the cliff, or walking on the mist.
Come up here! Do not mind the water!
Quentin was already running after him. Derwin and Inchkeith traded doubtful stares.
It seems all chances for a peaceful night have vanished.
And a dry one. We may as well have our bath and be done with it.
The two followed Quentin around the rocky edge of the pool at the base of the fall. The rocks were wet and slippery, making the way slow and laborious for the two older men. Quentin fairly skipped over the rocks and soon came to stand at the edge of the plunging torrent. Derwin saw him smile, look back over his shoulder at them, and then step into the churning water.
Do just as I did. I will wait for you.
After you, good hermit. I will follow in your wake. 'Tis only fitting. This is your expedition after all.
So it is.
With that, Derwin stepped into the glassy curtain of rushing water.
Courage, men! Fight on! Our deliverance is near!
The Dragon King has come! We are saved!
Beto raised his eyes to the wood. Faintly, as in a dream, he saw the glitter of gold and scarlet flicker among the shadowy boles and branches of trees like dancing light. And then suddenly, he saw it full and fair. The writhing, angry dragon, the king's blazon, floating swiftly toward them, darting through the trees.
Strike, bold knights! Strike now!
The Ningal before them, unable to meet an attack from both sides at once, scattered like leaves before the storm. In moments, the stalwart band of defenders was surrounded, not by enemy, but by comrades in arms. The bloodied knights lifted their swords with weary arms. The fresh forces of the Lords of Mensendor charged into the confused Ningal. Beto and Ronsart, battered and bleeding, stood leaning on their swords. They looked up and saw Escobar grinning down upon them from his great white charger.
We had all but given up hope, but Thedo here thought differently.
Another premonition?
No, well, in a way, yes. At first I thought it might hearten the men to hear our trumpets sound the call. And if there was a chance that anyone was passing near, they would hear and come to our aid. I cannot say where that idea came from.
However, it was your clarion guided us to you forthwith. You and your men fall back through the wood. We will take these and put an end to it here and now!
Sire!
Mirmior came running up from the thick of the fighting. Beto and Ronsart had not seen him since he had stood with him on the hillside.
The Ningal across the river are swarming over the barriers, now that there are no archers to hold them back. Do not think you will crush them so easily. Even now they are working to gain advantage on two sides.
What? By the gods, these warlords are cunning wolves!
Unless you have brought more men with you than I see hereabout, I suggest we should retreat while we have means and strength to do so!
As you say, Mirmior. Beto, Ronsard, get your men behind us and take yourselves away towards Ascalon!
Beto and Ronsard gathered the tattered remnant of their once powerful force and left the field. They pushed back through the forest along the path Escobar and his knights had forged through the wood. After they had walked nearly half a league, the forest thinned, and they came to a fresh-running brook. There they stopped to kneel and drink.
We must press on. If we tarry much longer, they will bury us here.
If we had horses, we would have a chance. When Escobar sounds the retreat, they will soon pass us by. A knight on foot is no knight at all. His armor was not made for marching.
I do not welcome the thought of being left behind when the army comes by. But look, good Thedo!
Ronsard pointed across the brook to a clearing where a line of wagons rumbled toward them.
You have only to speak your mind and it is done. Today is your day, my friend.
Aye, it certainly seems so.
In moments, Escobar's surgeons were scurrying among them, removing gorgets and breastplates, greaves and brassards and mail shirts, attending to the wounds of the knights. The sun was westering when Thedo and Ronsard stepped into the Lee. They had waited until all of their men had been tended and had either walked out of the forest or had been carried out and placed in a wagon. Looking around, they saw several men leading horses. Unbelievably, they were their own chargers. The animals separated from the riders during the fight had headed toward home and had been collected by the squires. Many of the knights found their own mounts. Others took the mount of a fallen friend.
Be mounted, men! To Ascalon!
They turned and rode west through the forest once more and were joined by the first of Escobar's retreating army, grim-faced and sullen. Soon, knights were streaming from the wood. Thedo identified the devices and colors of the various lords. Beniot's silver and blue double eagle, Fincher's gauntlet of gray on a crimson field clasping thunderbolts of white, Rudd's red ox on sable.
I do not see Ameronis, Lupolin, or their party.
Nor do I. Perhaps Wortwin will convince them yet. Let us so hope in any case.
Where is Mirmior got to? I would thank him for his valor and sharp wits on the field today.
His will be the last blow dealt, if I know him at all.
Ronsard turned in the saddle and spied a rank emerging from the wood.
Here, Thedo. Yonder comes Escobar. And yes, Mirmior is with him. And the lords.
In a moment, the other lords had caught the two knights.
Is the enemy pursuing?
Yes.
Clearly, Lord Rudd did not like retreating any more than the others. Probably less.
But they are afoot for the most part. If we continue, we should outdistance them shortly. I say we should rally in the wood ahead and wait for them.
We could foolishly allow ourselves to be cut to ribbons in the night.
Fire glinted in Mirmior's dark eyes. He was angered and turned his horse away from the others and rode away after glaring at those around him defiantly.
He speaks the truth. We have underestimated this enemy from the beginning. We will do well not to try doing it twice in one day. Retreat to Ascalon is the only cure for our malady, my lords. We will have little enough time to prepare for a siege. Let us make best use of it.
The march back to Ascalon was somber. It was dark when the enemy reached the plain below the castle, and though the moon had not yet risen, the ominous wolf star was burning brightly, shedding a chill light upon the land. That night, the armies of the Dragon King felt the sting of that cold light. All regarded it bleakly, and strong men quaked inside with fear, for they knew an evil day had come. Stepping through the waterfall was like stepping through a glass curtain. At the extreme edge where they entered, the tumbling water did not have the force it did in the center of the falls. Once through, the explorers found stone steps cut into a rock face that inclined away from the vertical plunge of the mountain wall. The steps led up under an overhanging roof of rock to a landing of sorts, a natural bartizan. There, Derwin and Inchkeith found Quentin and Tolly waiting for them as they came lumbering up the stairs.
This is the lost mine, the secret of the Auriga, look!
Quentin's left hand pointed ecstatically toward the near wall. In near total darkness, Inchkeith looked and saw strange figures carved in the stone, glowing with a pale golden light. He could not make them out. They appeared to be shapes of letters in some unknown hand. But looking at them made him think of men and mountains, and the waterfall churning, and rivers and trees, and the fullness of the earth. Derwin stepped to the wall and began tracing the inscriptions, which were deeply carved and looked fresh, as if the scribe had just laid away his chisel. The lines were straight and well-formed, untouched by weather or age.
These are the minds of the Auriga, friends of the earth and all living things. There seems no doubt but that we have found what we seek. Shall we go further, or wait until daylight to bring our provisions and tools up here?
It was a needless question. The piercing look of bright expectation on Quentin's face and Tolly's quiet excitement were enough to answer.
Very well. We can start at once. But we will need a light first. Someone must go back for the torches, so we may as well bring up all the supplies at once.
Tolly and I will go. You and Inkeith may stay here, and we will return at once.
Well, we may rescue some sleep from this night yet. It will take them 2 hours at least to return to camp and bring our things. We may as well rest while we can. I think it will be our last for a long while to come.
They settled down against the far wall, and Derwin fell asleep almost at once. Inchkeith pulled his coat around him and breathed the cool, musty air of the deep earth which rose up from the mineshaft somewhere away in the blackness beyond. But sleep had abandoned him completely. He was wide awake and could not take his eyes from the wonderful inscription shining softly from the opposite wall. Even though it merely marked the entrance to a mine, such an ordinary thing, Inchkeith thought he had never seen anything so inexplicably beautiful.
Derwin! Inchkeith!
So soon. So it is. I feel as if I just dozed off. How did they manage so quickly?
Derwin and Inchkeith hurried, with careful dignity, down the steps to the filmy curtain of water and stepped out into a night fading into a pearly dawn.
Such a rude awakening.
Quentin was untying bundles from a horse and Tolly was leading the other, loaded down with packs and tools.
I should have guessed. This night their feet would have wings. Well, let us begin. Our labor is before us.
Inchkeith only nodded. He had been strangely silent since entering the mine. In another hour's time, they had carried up all of the provisions and tools they would need. Quentin, with only one useful arm, had carried the most, making more trips than the others, so eager was he to begin the search. He had no idea what lay in the depths of the mines below, but it greatly heartened him to be once more where the Araga had been, and to see again the works of their long-vanished hands. Being here, his thoughts turned toward Dekra. They piled all the baggage in the mouth of the mine and began dividing up the packs they would each carry. Inchkeith insisted on carrying his fair share, despite his deformity. Derwin allowed that he would need his strength to forge the sword and should therefore conserve his energy while he could. The way would be difficult enough. But Inchkeith would have none of it. In the end, he gathered up his various implements.
I carry my own tools, at least. No one touches this master's tools but the master himself.
The anvil, bellows, and heavier items belonging to the forge were left behind at the mine's entrance. The party was finally ready.
Now, one thing more, and we will begin. While I light the torches, I want each of you to go back outside and look at the valley in the dawn. Unless I am far wrong, it will be some time before any of us sees the light of day again. I want you all to fill your hearts with a pleasant memory against the time when darkness crowds our way.
They all went outside and gazed upon the bright green bowl of the peaceful valley. The morning light struck the curling mist with a golden radiance, and the mountain seemed crowned with flames of red gold. Shenadvelin lay smooth and deep and undisturbed, mirroring the limitless blue of a clean morning sky, brushed with the lacework of wispy white clouds. The thin mountain air smelled sweet and fresh, vastly different from the dank stale air of the mine. Quentin, though he appreciated Derwin's suggestion as a wise one, was anxious to be off. While he gazed about him intently, his mind was so full of new excitement he saw little. When they finally turned to go back into the mine, Tolly was the last to tear himself away from the beauty before him. Esme and Bria stood on the high barbican overlooking the gates of the castle and the town below. Its buildings clustered like a flock of timid sheep in the shadow of its great protector. On this fresh morning, though newborn and still fondling its night airs, the narrow, cramped streets were rivers of moving color, all surging at flood stage toward the gates below. Out on the plain, as far as Pelgrim's Dark Border, threads of travelers could be seen weaving their way to the city, to join the streams moving into the castle.
From where do they come? There must be whole villages of people down there.
True. Word travels on eagle's wings, does it not? It was just the day before yesterday that the lords returned from battle. Now look. Some of them have traveled all night to get here. I do not blame them, though. I would do the same.
Bria, we are friends, you and I, are we not?
Yes, of course. Why?
But I must tell you something as a friend would.
Speak freely.
We are women now, Bria. Royal women. There is no more room for girlish indulgences. You have eyes. You have seen. We are to endure siege here not many days hence. We must put away all thoughts of ourselves and begin thinking of others first. It must be done. We must be strong for the men who fight. for the people who will look to us for hope and encouragement, and only lastly for ourselves. For the sake of the kingdom, this must be. Our courage must be a flame which can kindle the hearts of those around us. That is a woman's duty in a time of war.
Your words pierce me, fair friend. What you say is true. I have walked in proud misery these past weeks, ever since Quinton left. I have been selfish. I have shown myself to be afflicted by the fate that took our loved ones from us, though others have better claim to such recourse than I. But no more, Esme, no more. You have spoken the truth as a friend ought. I will put away girlish airs and simpering. I will be strong, that those around me will take strength too, and not be at pains to cheer myself when there is more important work to do. I will be strong, Esme. Come, let us do what we can to see to the accommodations for the villagers seeking refuge within these walls.
They turned away from the barbican and began walking along the southern battlements.
I feel such a fool, Esme. Forgive me.
No, do not chide yourself. I did not speak so to reproach you, for you are far more tender-hearted than I.
If that were so, I should have been comforting you, Esme. You are far from home, and no news has come of the fighting there or of your family. You must be very worried.
I am, though it was part of my father's plan to send me here and thus remove me from the threat of war. I honor him by holding to the course he set for me, though I am sure he scarcely guessed that mighty Ascalon would fall under siege.
Their talk had brought them to the great curtain which divided the inner ward from the outer. They stood looking down into the outer ward at the mass of people moving about, constructing tents and temporary lodgings for themselves. Cattle, pigs, and chickens had been brought along to provide food, should the siege prove a long one. The warder and his men were scurrying around directing the flow of humanity here and there, trying to keep the pathways open for soldiers who would be moving through.
Can the castle possibly hold all these people?
I have never seen anything like it. Though it is said that in the Winter's War, 100,000 were besieged here all winter. But that was long, long ago.
The princesses looked down upon the frightened populace and forgot their own cares.
Are you sure you want to go down there?
I am sure. There may be but little we can do for them, but that little shall be done.
The darkness was unlike anything Quentin had ever experienced. Far darker than the blackest night, it was a palpable thing, primitive and insistent. Almost as if alive, it crouched around each turn and on every side, waiting to smother all intruders in its velvet embrace. The torches they carried seemed fragile and ridiculous things, mere toys against an unrelenting foe of stupid, savage cunning. Still, the sputtering pitch torches served somehow to keep this awesome darkness at bay, though they always seemed to be on the verge of guttering out completely and plunging their bearers into a void as black as death. Each one carried a torch, except Inchkeith, who labored doggedly along, weighed down with his delving tools, as he called them. Derwin went ahead, relying on his sparse knowledge of Araga mining lore to serve as a guide. Quentin, his arm in a sling, but toting a large pack nonetheless, followed Derwin. Inchkeith hobbled along behind Quentin, and Tolly brought up the rear, grinding his teeth with every step into the mountain's black heart. After walking for what seemed days on end into the darkness along a low-roofed, wide corridor of solid stone, Derwin halted the party.
No doubt you young men could go on walking this way until Hoth himself stopped you in your tracks. But I think it is a time for a rest. A bite to eat would not be unwelcome either.
Take no thought for me, hermit. Do not stop on my account.
It is not for anyone but myself that I sit down, sir. My feet tell me it is time to rest a bit, and my stomach agrees.
They ate, and Quentin realized how hungry he was after all. As he munched, he wondered whether it was day or night outside, but in his mind he pictured it as exactly the way he had seen it last. Derwin had been right. It was a useful thing to carry a little sunlight with one into this dark hole. Tolly ate little and said less. He had grown sullen and had withdrawn into himself, becoming, if it were possible, even more quiet than usual. Quentin pretended to take no notice of his friend's behavior, for that would have only served to make it more painful to him. He knew precisely what was bothering Tolly. The Jair did not like the smothering confines of the mine. It was a supreme act of bravery for Tully, born of a people who roam the earth at will, following the wild creatures, to have even entered the hateful place, which seemed to him worse than a grave. And there was something of the same uneasiness which bothered Quentin, too. But in him it took the form of a puzzlement. The Araga, whose every work was a visible, tangible song, had constructed a most unappealing mineshaft. Not that Quentin had expected the brightly colored sweeping galleries of Dekra to be reproduced below, but he did anticipate something of their remarkable flair, which usually showed in even the most mundane articles of their everyday life, to be present here. All he could see was a black tunnel of stone, which glistened in patches where water seeped down its sides.
If I am not mistaken, we are still in the entrance shaft. Soon I think we will reach the first level. How many levels there are, I cannot say, nor on which one we shall find the lanthanil. We will search each level and every gallery until we find it. My own guess is that it lies very deep, and that we must descend to the lowest level.
You mentioned the lanthanil. I would hear more about it. For all I know is what little you have said and what I remember from Dekra, which is so wrapped in legend as to be beyond belief.
Oh, do not be so certain of that. Yes, often the stories men recite about such things do grow in the telling. But the Stone of Light, that is what the word means, roughly translated, is a most fantastic substance. It has many exotic and powerful properties.
If tales are to be believed, hear this one. Many years ago, my father was traveling the world with his father. He was but a small boy at the time, and they were seeking the secrets of weaponry and armor, of forging and forming rare metals, of setting gems in their bezels, all the craft which an armorer must know. In Pelagia, they met a merchant who sold arms, and they became friends when the merchant saw a sample of my grandfather's work. When the merchant realized that he was talking to a great craftsman, he took them in the back of his shop, for in that country, they had stalls outside covered with awnings, and inside, where the merchants and craftsmen lived and worked, they kept the very finest articles of their trade. To be invited inside was a considerable honor. This merchant, a very well-known and respectable man, I cannot recall if I ever heard his name, took them in and led them to a very small room in his large house. He unlocked the bolt across the door to this room and led them inside. My father said it was very dark. He remembered that the walls of the room were extremely thick, and the door was very heavy, for it groaned on its iron hinges like a drawbridge. The merchant closed the door and brought out a casket from some hidden place and put it before them on the table. The case was bound with locks and chains, though it was but a small one. When he had unlocked it, he took out an object wrapped in cloth. My father said the object was not large and appeared to be not of much weight, for the man handled it with ease and with great reverence. The merchant did not speak, but unwrapped the cloth and revealed a chalice of surpassing beauty. But the most remarkable of all the things that my father remembered most clearly until the day he died was the way it shined in the darkness, as if lit with an inner flame. He said he cried to look at it was so beautiful. But then, he was a small boy. He reached out to touch the shining cup, and the merchant pulled it away, saying it was enchanted, and that to touch it with bare hands diminished its power. He said it was very old, and its power was only a fraction of what it had been, but that was still great. He said that cordial sipped from the goblet cured it once, and that the very touch of it healed all infirmities. My father's father then did a very unusual thing. As proud as he was of his work, he said he would give the merchant his finest dagger for one touch of the chalice for himself and his son. My father noticed the strange look which came over his father's face as his voice pleaded. The dagger was finely wrought. It had a golden handle with rubies inset. It was worth a great deal, and yet the merchant hesitated. But in the end, he relented and let them touch the chalice. My father remembered how the light which leapt from the exquisite cup lit his father's face and seemed to infuse him with a new power of creating and a heightened understanding of his craft, though this was observed much later. When his father finally passed the chalice to him, he was afraid to touch it, but his father urged him to, and he did. He said he never felt such strength and wholeness, and nothing in his life ever moved him with such emotion after that. Oh, though he was but a small boy, he knew even then that he would never recover that feeling or see such beauty again. So he treasured it in his heart. My father spent the rest of his life trying to achieve in his craft the beauty that he saw in that cup. And you know, he lived far beyond the natural span of a man's years. He always said it was because of the chalice, and that had his father given 100 golden daggers, it would have been but a paltry sum for the gift of that one touch.
What became of your grandfather? How did it affect him?
His was not a happy fate. He too lived long and prospered. But he became obsessed with finding another chalice, or some other object made from the mysterious metal. And when he could not, he tried to make one himself. But he was always disappointed. For though his works became the most highly prized in all the realm, he was yet unsatisfied. He died bitter and broken, consumed with despair. Some said it was the despair that killed him in the end.
Did your father not share his fate then?
To some degree, yes. He too was never satisfied with the work of his hands after having held the chalice. But you must remember, he was a small boy. I believe his heart was yet innocent and untutored in the ways of the world. The touch of the chalice, rather than leading to bitterness in the end, inflamed him with a burning desire to seek that beauty. He died at last unfulfilled, it is true, but not unhappy for that.
Your story is most moving. I begin to see now why the Most High has chosen you to accompany us on this journey. It seems your family has some part to play here.
If the outer wards were filled with a frenzy of frightened citizens, the inner wards were filled with soldiers, feverishly preparing for the impending siege. A steady stream of soldiers marched from the base of the southern tower, emerging from the dungeon with armloads of spears and bundles of swords. Others, bent to the task in smaller groups, labored over objects of wood, rope, and iron on the ground. They were assembling the machines of war. Still others tied piles of straw into bundles and sewed heavy pieces of cloth and skins together. Horses were led to the stables around the ward yard, where squires sat at whetstone sharpening sword, lance, spear, and halberd. Provisions brought up from the town by the wagon load were stacked away in kitchens and pantries by cooks and their helpers. Dogs chased cackling chickens and hawking flocks of geese, while children, uninhibited by the danger and excited by the bustle of activity around them, ran and played, dodging the footsteps of their elders and staging pretend battles. Escavar roamed the battlements like a shade. He seemed to be everywhere at once. His commanders looked up to see him watching them as they drilled the troops. The dungeon keeper found him inquiring about the level of water in the reservoir, dipping the measuring rod himself. The squires were instructed in better sharpening technique by one whose hand bore the royal signet. At the end of the day, there did not seem to be anyone anywhere within the walls who had not seen him.
Sire, I must protest. Derwin would tell you if he were here, and so I tell you in his stead. Listen to him, if not to me. You must rest. Your strength is but half recovered, and your ride into battle has tired you. Rest, I say, and let your commanders make ready all that is necessary.
You little guess the danger gathering at our gates. Who is there to look at these preparations if not the king?
What good will you be to your people when you lie exhausted on your bed, unable to even lift your head, let alone wield a sword or shout a command? Rest now while you may.
I'm sound enough, I tell you. My strength is none of your concern.
How so, sire? It is now the concern of every man and child in the realm who would see his king deliver him from the hand of the enemy. You need rest. Gather your strength that the day of the trial does not find you enfeebled.
Enfeebled? The way you talk, and to your king, by the gods. There is much to do, and someone must look to it that it be done well.
Bjorkis did not see him the rest of the day, though he waited near his chamber for the king to return. It was strange to wake in the vast darkness of the mine. When Quentin opened his eyes, he did not know that he had opened them at all. The sensation of blindness was so overpowering that for a moment Quentin's heart clenched in his chest, until he remembered where he was and how he had come to be there. Just to make sure, he winked both eyes several times, but could discern no difference. So he lay on the hard, uneven stone and waited, not inclined to bump around in an attempt to light a torch. The others were still asleep. He would wait. They had made two more long marches before fatigue overtook them, and Derwin decided they must sleep before moving on. They had reached the first level shortly after they had stopped to rest and eat the first time. The corridor with a low roof had ended in a steep incline that emptied upon a room of indeterminable size. But they had no light to see how large the room was, for the torchlight failed to illuminate its furthest dimensions. They had crossed the great room, passing huge columns of reddish stone carved of the rock of the mountain's core, rising up out of the floor like monstrous trees sweeping up from the ground, their tops lost in the inky blackness above. Quentin counted 20 such pillars before they reached the far end of the room, which tapered to a huge arch through which they passed. The arch bore the unmistakable marks of having been made by Araga stonecutters. Quentin would have liked to stand and admire it, but they passed quickly on. The next corridor was more difficult to navigate than the first. It was wider and its roof higher, allowing for more freedom of movement, but numerous shafts and galleries opened off of it, often abruptly and at slight angles. It forked in several places, splitting off to the right and left. Sometimes they would pass by an opening which Quentin could not see until he felt a chill breeze on his face and smelled the dank, musty odor of stale air and stone. Once they crossed a stone bridge that arched across a wide crevice, splitting the floor before them in a sharp divide. On the bridge, Quentin felt a warm updraft and guessed that the rift was the chimney of some subterranean fire eternally blazing. Each time Derwin came to a fork or a turn which offered a choice of paths to follow, the hermit elected to take the one which promised a downward course. He admitted he had no precise notion of what they were looking for, but had the idea that the highly prized ore they sought lay at the deepest levels of the mine. They had rested in a curious domed chamber on the far side of the stone bridge. They talked among themselves at first, but somehow through fatigue or through the wearing oppression of the deep darkness, the conversation seemed to dry up like a trickle of water in the desert sand, vanishing slowly, without a trace of its having ever been there. Though tired and aching from the weight of the packs they carried, they had decided to press on. The slope of the downward track increased dramatically once they left the domed chamber. With the extra weight they carried on their shoulders, the falling grade impelled them onward at a faster pace than they would have normally had strength or inclination to attempt. The result was that they reached the second level in what seemed no time at all. Quentin knew they had been walking some hours when they tumbled into the enormous cavern that formed the central chamber of the second level. But time had ceased to function in its normal way. Hours collapsed and minutes stretched out incredibly until it seemed that time had no meaning at all unless it was measured in footsteps or in tunnels passed. They had been walking in silence, each wrapped in his own thoughts as in a hooded cloak from head to toe, when Quentin felt a touch at his elbow.
Tully! You scared me. I did not hear you creeping up behind me.
Excuse me, Kenta. I did not mean to alarm you.
Tully looked at Quentin with large, shining eyes, as deep as fathomless pools. Looking at those large, dark eyes, glittering in the quavering light of the torch, was like looking into the eyes of a wild and frightened animal.
What is it, Tully? Is something the matter?
My people do not love dark places. We have never lived in caves. In ages before this one, when holes and caves were home to many men, my people lived in the forest and made their homes in the light. There are still those among us who speak of the times of the cave dwellers. Some even have been inside caves when they come upon them in the forest. But I have never been.
All at once, Quentin realized what Tolly was trying to tell him, and he realized what strength it had taken for the Jair to follow him into this dark place. To Tolly, it was not a mine. It was an ancestral taboo, which out of love for his master, he was willing to put aside. But the darkness and the endless walkways of stone boring ever deeper into the bowels of the earth had at last stripped Tolly of the veneer of civilization he had acquired in living with his Kenta. He was the Jair Prince once more, wild as the free creatures of the Wilderlands.
We will soon be finished here, Tolly. Do not fear. You will see the living land once again, and very soon.
Quentin felt the emptiness of his own words. The more so when Tolly turned an uncomprehending glassy stare upon him and seemed not to recognize him at all. Quentin had the odd feeling that he was looking at a stranger whose face was as familiar as his own. The Tolly he knew had vanished.
Demor Ivy, Tolly. Demor Ivy. Demor Ivy.
Quentin had racked his brain for some smattering of the Jair speech he could use, and that was what he had come up with. It meant, hold on. Hold on. Quentin rolled over in the darkness and was startled to see a faint light bouncing toward him out of the formless void. It seemed to float or swim in the darkness, and it blinked like the eye of some cave beast that had happened upon their trail and was now stalking them. He watched as the light grew brighter by degrees. Quentin sat up, wondering whether to wake the others and warn them. Someone was coming down the passageway toward the chamber where they had huddled to sleep. But even as Quentin framed the thought, the feeling of danger passed. He waited, and presently the light burst through the arched entrance to the chamber, filling the room, or so it seemed to Quentin's light-deprived eyes, with a sun-like brilliance.
So it is. You are awake, Quentin. Come with me. I want to show you something.
But the others?
Let them sleep. It is not far. Come along.
Quentin stood stiffly and found at once how sore his feet were. He padded after Derwin, who lifted the torch high so both could use it as they entered once more the main tunnel they had been following on their last march. Presently, they came to a small arched entrance in the side of the passageway.
I have been wandering long up and down this gallery. I only saw this when I was returning to the chamber to sleep a little while ago. I decided to try it. Follow me.
His curiosity piqued. Quentin stooped and ducked under the arch. At once they were in the uncomfortably close confines of a low and narrow wormhole tunnel that twisted and turned, with barely enough room for a man to stand erect. The tunnel fell away steeply, far more rapidly than Quentin thought safe. It seemed as if the tunnel would suddenly pitch down, and he would find himself falling into a bottomless well. But Derwin seemed to have no fear, lurching along as quickly as his legs would carry him. So Quentin kept his fears to himself and followed dutifully along. They came to a narrow place at the end of the tunnel, but Quentin saw Derwin turn sideways and disappear into a crack just wide enough to squeeze through. He too turned his shoulders and scraped through the thin opening. As he came through, Quentin felt Derwin grab him by the shoulders and lay down the torch so that he could see, but he only stood on a narrow ledge. Then Derwin smiled at him in the glow of the torch, his face gleaming with ferocious glee.
What is it, Derwin?
What is it? What is it indeed? I will show you.
The hermit took the torch and with a mighty heave sent it spinning off into the darkness beyond.
No, wait!
Watch!
Quentin could see nothing and worried about the torch. How were they to find their way back again? But then, a strange and wonderful thing happened. As he watched, he imagined that he saw the stars of heaven come peeping out, one by one, into the blackness surrounding them. At first, these stars were but the tiniest slivers of light, but they began to grow.
What are you...
Above him, the vaulted roof of the enormous chamber had begun to shine with a soft amber luminescence that blushed pink like a winter sunrise. The far walls held glimmering green traces like liquid light streaking down. The floor of the cavern far below shone with its own ghostly light in irregular splotches here and there in seams of blue and gold. Within moments, though to Quentin it seemed like the slow dawning of day, the vast chamber was radiating light from all sides, and Quentin was swept away with incredulous joy.
Derwin.
Yes, Quentin. We have found it! It is the Lanthanil!
By the fierce light of the Wolfstar, the sentinels watched them coming. Although it was the sixth hour of the night, the cold glow of the awful star cast a light as bright as day upon the plain. The star had grown to fill the entire eastern sky, obliterating all lesser lights. And by the light of their savage star, the Ningal came to Ascalon.
Come to Ascalon, you barbarian horde. Come and meet your doom.
The commanders who had gathered around him exchanged worried glances, for Escavar's countenance burned with a feverish glow of a ravening wolf.
See how they come? I feel their hated feet upon the land. I feel their evil intent deep in my inmost parts. But the dragon's heart is in me. It is of iron. I am not afraid.
The lords shrank away from the Dragon King. Even those who had served in the wars against Goliath had never seen him so. His eyes started from his head and his mouth was taut. His high, noble brow shone smooth and tight in the starlight.
This is a wonder, is it not, my lords? Look upon it. See how willingly they come to the slaughter. See the accursed marching to their destruction. But have no pity for them, my lords. They deserve what they shall receive. They shall be cut down.